Okay, good morning. Let's see. So we were looking at Riemann integrable functions, and my thought for today is to try to expand a little bit on the space of Riemann integrable functions. Okay, so we already have learned a few things about them, but I'd like to add some more. So more about the space R int AB of Riemann integrable functions. Okay, so that's the plan for today. All right, so let me just remind you of a couple of things that we already know. So we already have some facts about this. And in the end, there is a reasonable, a little bit complicated characterization. We're not going to get all the way there. I'll state it. But but we're not going to prove the last little bits required. But we'll get a pretty good feel for what all of them look like, and also we'll build more than the ones we already have. So we already found a few things about it. So we found that R int is a vector space. So if I have two of them, I can add them, and I can multiply them by constants. And so that allows me to get a whole bunch more. It's a vector space. And this, I guess, was 1132 and 1133. Okay, so that was, I guess, up here. Yeah, we just proved that, right? So 1133 says that I can add two elements and they're still in R int. And 1132 over here said that I can multiply by a constant and I'm still in R int. Okay, so that gives me one way to build new functions that are integrable. Let's see, the other thing we did was we found some sets that were already there. So C0 is contained in R int. So all of the continuous functions are integrable. And the increasing functions also. So that's a collection of functions. And we actually have some other functions. So we know we haven't got everything yet. So for example, if I take the characteristic function that's f of x is equal to one if x is equal to a half and zero otherwise, we know that this is also an integrable. And that's not in my list above. So we haven't got everything, right? So we've got a bunch of functions, but there's still more, right? So we kind of like to figure out what some of the other ones are. Okay. Right, and in fact, actually, does everyone remember what the integral of that one is, by the way? So if I graph this, this is a function that's just jumps at that one point in the middle there. So the integral from 0 to 1 of f of x dx. So remember that one? It's zero, right? Yeah, because whatever we take, the bottom one's always going to be zero, and the top one we can make as thin as possible. So we're going to sandwich it between epsilon and zero. So that one's zero, all right? So that's a collection. Okay, so that's what we know. And now let me add a few facts. So the first thing that I want to do is add a measure of bigness. Something like a norm. It's not quite a norm, but it's close, and it is a norm in some subspaces. And that's what I want to show today. So definition. And since it's almost a norm and it's a norm in some subspaces, we'll use norm notation for it. So I'll write if we have f an integrable function Then the L1 norm. So I want to measure how big it is, and so I'm going to take an integral of something positive. So I'm going to take the integral from a to b of the absolute value of f of x dx. Okay, so that's going to be something like a norm. And let me just recall what it means to be a norm and see how close we get. Okay, so recall. Well, we have a vector space, and so that's a good start. And if we have a vector space and a norm and bars, this is a norm linear space. And this is definition 13.20 in your text. So remember what it needs. So X is a vector space, real vector space. Okay, that's good. My R is a real vector space, right? So that's a start. So we've got that part. And then there are three properties that we need. And so we need the zero property. If the norm of F is equal to zero, then F is equal to zero. Okay, we need the scaling property. If we have a constant C and R, then the norm of CF is equal to the absolute value of C times the norm of F. And we need the triangle. If we have two functions, F and G in X, then the norm of their sum is bounded by the sum of their norms. Okay, those are the three things we need. And I'm gonna try to prove each of those, but as I've advertised, it's not quite a norm. And so can anyone see why this first one is does not work? So R int AB with this L1 norm is not a norm linear space. Since, yeah, exactly. As mentioned here in the text, wrong, thank you. The example given above is exactly a counterexample, right? Because here's a function which is not the zero function, right? But its norm here, the integral of its absolute value, since it's positive, it's just its integral, is zero, okay? So here we have something whose L1 norm is zero, even though the function is not, okay? So that's the problem. But it turns out that's the only problem. And in some sense, it's kind of a minor problem, but it is a problem. And it's not a normal linear space. Since, e.g., f above has L1 norm equal to zero, but of course the function I just wrote is not zero. Right. Okay, so the zero fails. Okay. But the other ones do, okay? So let me prove the other two and then prove that the zero one at least holds for the continuous functions. So the continuous functions with L0 do form a norm linear space, okay? All right, so those are the three things that I want to prove next. And one of them I'll let you guys do in the breakout. Let me start by proving scaling. So claim So I'm going to the zero one, as you can see now, is kind of the trickiest because it's false. Okay, so that one's tricky, but the other two are true. And so let me just start with the other two. So claim scaling. All right, so I claim the scaling one holds. So let me just write that out. If I have a real number C, and I have a function which is Riemann integrable on AB, then the L1 norm of C times F is just equal to the absolute value C times the L1 norm of F. Okay. Let me prove that. And what I want to make use of is the scaling property that we had last time. Let's see if it fits. Not quite, I can't put them both on the screen, so I'll have to scroll it back up, I apologize. But I'm gonna use this proposition 32, right? That said that if I take the integral of a constant times a function, the constant just pulls out, okay? So that's essentially what I need to prove. All I did is I have some absolute values in there, otherwise it's the same. So let me just do that. So proof, use the integral of C times g of x dx is always equal to C times the integral of g of x dx. Okay, so that's what I'm gonna use. All right, so let's just compute. All right, so the L1 norm of C times F, which is what we're trying to get our hands on here. So by definition, that's just the integral of the absolute value of C times F, left a little space there, dx. But the absolute value of a product is the product of the absolute value, so I might as well split those up like so. Okay, and now I'm exactly in the situation of 11.32. So then this is equal to 11.32 absolute value of C times the integral of the absolute value of f of x dx, and that's what we wanted. So this is equal to the absolute value of C times the L1 norm of f, okay? So we're done. Okay, so we have the scaling one works over here. Yeah. All right, so that one we've got. All right, so next let me do the triangle inequality. Actually, I'm gonna let you guys do the triangle inequality. Let me just set it up for you and then let you guys try it. Claim triangle. If we have two functions, so just copying the triangle inequality. So if f and g are Riemann integrable on the interval from A to B, then the L1 norm of the sum is supposed to be less than or equal to the sum of the L1 norms. Note that I keep calling it a norm, even though it's not on all of Rn, but it is on the continuous functions, and there is a modification to Rn where it is. Okay, so proof. So we want to use 11.33, and see if I have that up here. Yeah, here we go. So this is what we worked out last time, that if I take the integral of a sum, that's the same as the sum of the integrals, right? So the integral was a linear function. So that was what we proved last time. And that's what we're gonna use here. 11.33, the integral of f plus g is equal to the integral of f plus the integral of g, okay? And we're gonna use 39, I guess, or 36. here that it's a corollary of 39. It says that if I have a function f that's less than g, then the integrals are monotone. Okay, so it's a monotonicity of the integral. 36, the integral if f is less than or equal to g, then the integral of f is less than or equal to the integral of g. Okay, so so try to put those together to get a proof of this here. I'll give you guys just a few minutes to try that, just to warm up a little bit here. Okay, let's see. So did the people manage to figure out how to get that to work?
Yeah, I think we got it.
All right, so let's just try it here. So let me just, I'll start and you can tell me what you know. So let me just start with the thing you're trying to compute here. All right, so how did you bound that?
We started by using the definition of the L prime norm.
All right.
And then here, I'm not sure if this is the right order to go in, but we applied triangle inequality and theorem 11.36 to get that the integral is less than or equal to the integral of the absolute value of f plus absolute value of g.
Sounds good.
And then 11.33 gives you what you want after that.
Exactly. So use 11.36. And then 11.33, the linearity, then you can split it up into the two integrals.
Shouldn't 11.33 be just equal, or is it?
Oh, thank you. Yes, it should. You're exactly correct. Sorry, you just missed right. Thank you. Thanks. Okay, so did anyone find a different approach where this is what everyone did? Good. Okay, so we've got the last one holds. And so, but we've already seen that the first one does not. Okay, so it's almost a norm linear space, except that we have too many functions whose integral is zero. So one way to fix that, there are various ways, and we're only going to do one of them here, although in your next functional analysis course, you'll see another way to do it, the L1 space. But we're going to look at the continuous functions. That's one way to fix it. And so we can just restrict to continuous functions. So let me write that down as a claim and then prove it. So a claim, let's see, this is 11.42 in the text. Okay, so it says that the first one, the zero property, at least holds if we restrict to continuous functions. So another, so to write that out, if we have f a continuous function instead of just any old Riemann integrable function. Okay, so in particular, we're throwing out this this bad case that we had over here, right? That one's not continuous. And then we can go to the zero statement. So the zero statement says the L1 norm of f is equal to zero. Then the claim is that the function itself is zero. Okay. All right, so let me try to prove that. So proof. Okay, let me just draw a little picture of what I'm going to do and then translate that into some equations. All right, so the picture goes as follows. I have my function. It's continuous and it's not zero. So actually, maybe I'll put that over here. So assume for contradiction that we have f is continuous and non-zero, but its integral is zero. Assume for contradiction that f is continuous, f of c is non-zero, and the integral, the L1 norm is equal to zero. Okay, so then we want to get a contradiction. And the way we're going to get a contradiction is as follows. So our function was non-zero here at some point c, okay? And unlike this function over here, which could be non-zero just at c and zero everywhere else, our function has to be continuous, okay? So it has to have nearby values at nearby points. So it's going to be, maybe it tries to get down to zero, but it takes it some time, okay? So it's going to be something that's continuous there. And so then the idea is that I want to build a partition, right, that will witness the size of the integral. And I'm going to take a partition that cuts a little piece here to let's say C minus some delta, okay? And then when I take this, the partition, which is just A here and C minus delta and C and B, so just has those four bits, and then I compute the lower bound of the integral based on that partition, just that simple partition with four pieces, then I'm going to get this piece here, which is contributing, and it's not zero. Okay, so I'm going to get something here. All right, so let me do that. Okay, so now let me write that out as a formulas. Okay. All right, so assume, to write, so f of c was non-zero, so we will write the absolute value of f of c equals 2 epsilon, just so it has a name, so we're going to call that 2 epsilon, okay? And now we're going to use the fact that it's continuous to get a delta, okay? Since f is continuous, so what does continuity tell us? It says that for each epsilon, like this epsilon, there exists some delta, and let me take it bigger than zero, so that whenever I have a point here that's within delta of C, so in this little interval from C minus delta up to C, so for all absolute value of X minus C being less than delta, so inside that little interval, I have that the difference between f of c and f of x is less than epsilon. Okay, but if the difference between f of c and f of x, and actually I'm going to work with the absolute values. So let me just write all these as absolute values. Okay, so I'm just going to work with the absolute value of my function because that's what I'm integrating. Okay, so if that difference is less than epsilon, what's the biggest that f of x can be? Is that clear? So this f of c, what is f of c?
Can't be bigger than epsilon, right?
Exactly, that's right. Because f of c is just 2 epsilon. And so if it differs from 2 epsilon by at most epsilon, this is at least epsilon. Okay, so everyone see that? So as we started out here at 2 epsilon, and we subtracted off something less than epsilon, so this has to be bigger than or equal to epsilon. Okay, for the height of that, maybe I'll write that in red, the height of that red box. Okay. Okay, and so then we're essentially done. So, absolute value of f of x is bigger than or equal to epsilon, okay? And so consider the partition, just the one that I advertised above, it's gonna be A and epsilon minus delta and, that's supposed to be a C minus delta, not an epsilon minus delta, C minus delta and C and B, or A and C. I'm going to take one either on one side or the other. It doesn't matter which, but either one. So plus delta B. Then the lower integral that I get for the absolute value of F involving this P is bigger than or equal to. So the first one is going to be something positive. Or non-negative at least, because it's a positive function, plus, and then I have this delta times epsilon, and then I have something else that's positive, okay? So this is bigger than or equal to delta times epsilon, which is bigger than zero, but the actual integral which is my one norm, is bigger than that. And so this is a contradiction. And we are done. Okay, any questions about that? About those steps? Okay, so basically, since there has to be a little bit of space here where it's close to where it's big, I get some area underneath it. That's really what's happening. Okay, actually, can anyone see why I did this funny little thing where I took it either to be the left interval or the right interval? What if C were over on the edge?
Wouldn't you just have to use the right interval in that case?
Exactly, that's right. So it could be that one of my intervals actually goes off the edge, but they can't both go off the edge. So that's why I can do both. Okay, so that's the proof. All right, so what did we do? So, right, so this holds, this one fails, but holds for C0. Okay, so as a result, we did end up with a new non-linear space. So corollary, C0 AB with the norm L1 is a non-linear space. Okay, so at least we got that. Okay, let me just do one more thing with this norm, and actually then we'll come back and use it later. It's actually quite handy. But then what I want to do is expand further the space of functions that are integrable. So one little note here, claim. If I have a bounded function, an integrable function, I can compare the two norms that I have. So what's the other norm linear space I have with this set of functions? What's the other norm here?
Oh. Wasn't C prime?
So C prime worked for the smaller space of differentiable functions of C1.
Oh, okay.
Right. So this one used the soup norm. For C prime, you had to be able to differentiate. Okay, so we have those two, and they are related in the following sense. Claim, if I have a function which is continuous, actually bounded is enough. Maybe I'll just write Riemann integrable, which is what we need here. So AB, I can compare these two norms, and if I look at the L1 norm, it's at most the length of my interval times the largest value that it achieves. Okay, so that's a handy fact, which we'll come back to later. Let me just prove it. I hope it's clear that that should be true. If I have some function over here, on AB, and I'm trying to find the area under it, Well, if I find the maximum value, I'm not quite sure where it is. Maybe it's that one over there, right? This red area is clearly bigger than the black area. Okay, so that's all I need to use. Okay, so proof. Consider. So this, I need a very, very simple partition. I'm just going to take the partition that's got A and B in it only, and just use that one. Okay, so consider the partition P equals just A comma B. Okay, and then we'll just compute. So then the L1 norm of F is by definition the integral from A to B of f of x dx, which is less than or equal to the upper integral associated to the partition AB. But what is that? This is just equal to, it's only got one piece, right? And so it's the length times the height. And so it's equal to the length, which is just B minus A times the height, which is the sup over X in the interval A to B of F of X. Oops, I left out my absolute values. I apologize. Right, didn't have absolute values there. So the sup of the absolute value of the absolute value, which is just the absolute value. Okay, and so this is then equal to, but the sup is just the definition of the sup norm. So this is just B minus A times the sup norm. Okay, so that's, so we can use the very simplest partition, and it gives it to us. Okay, any questions about that? All right, very good. So that's something we will use this later. But for now, I want to go back and try to expand the collection of functions that are integrable. Okay, so. Add integrable functions. Okay, so let's see. So we already have a few. Let me just remind you what we know. Already know. That our function that our int AB is a vector space, contains the continuous functions, contains increasing functions and also and decreasing functions. And contains this function, which isn't on my list yet. Okay, so it's clear that we're not done, right? There are more functions out there that are integrable, and this is kind of a hodgepodge that we have right now. But it turns out there's a kind of clean way to do it, fairly clean, and it goes as follows. So we use the following two extra facts. So let's see, these are 11.44. Which says that I can take two integrable functions and just stick them together and I'll get another integrable function. Okay, so that enables us to build a lot of functions that way. So 11.44, f, a bounded function f, I guess that's redundant because I'm gonna write BDD here, on AB is, integrable by which I mean Riemann integrable if and only if. Okay, so here's an equivalent statement. I'm going to take C to be inside of AB. I forgot to give myself a C. So the picture here is I have my A, I have my B, and I have a C, and all I'm going to ask is that it be integrable on each side. And then the whole thing is integrable. Okay, so if and only if F restricted to AC and is Riemann integrable. And similarly, when I restrict it to CB. Okay, so I need both sides to be integral, and then I can just stick them together and I get something that's integrable. Okay, proof.
Professor?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't this allow C to be A, and could that give us problems?
So if C is equal to A, what it says is it's still true. Yes, it does allow it. And what happens is that it becomes a vacuous statement because it says that that we have a integral that if it's integrable, if and only if it's integrable, is basically what it says.
Right. But aren't we trying to keep these functions with like point discontinuities out of R space?
No, we're not. We're trying to figure out the right answer. And those are integrable.
Okay.
That's the idea. I'm trying to figure out all the functions that are integrable. I'm not trying to cut down like I did before. Now I'm just trying to figure out all of them.
I see.
Yeah. So really what we're trying to figure out is just how bad those point discontinuities can be. That's really what we're trying to figure out. That's where we are. Okay. All right. So, so something like this, or as you say, with point discontinuities, just could jump in the middle, and that's fine. That's a class of functions that I'm happy to identify. All right, and so proof. So if let me do it this way. So I'm going to compute the L and the U. And show that they are equal, right? So that's what I need to do. So let me see, let me assume that, so this is an if and only if statement, right? So I need to go both directions, oops. If and only if, so I need to go both directions, right? And so let me do one of them first. So let me assume these two things and prove that one, all right? So let me do that. So this direction, so assume that F restricted to AC, and F restricted to CB are integrable. Okay. And then I want to prove that F is. And prove. Okay, so actually what I'm going to do is a little bit more. I guess I should have said it here. Maybe I will say it here. I apologize. I should have added it. I'll put it in a different color. I can also write down what the integral is. Since they're integrable, the integral exists. So the integral from A to B of F of x dx, is it clear what that should be? Right, if I integrate over here, I can just integrate here and I can integrate here and I just add. Okay, so they just add up and that's true. So this is an integral from A to C of f of x dx plus the integral dx plus the integral from c up to b f of x dx. So this is what you would have expected. And actually we're going to prove that in the process of proving that it exists. Okay, so that's going to be what we do. So we're going to show that the L and the U are the same, and then we'll be done. Then we'll have that it's integrable. So show that L of the function f is equal to u of the function f. That's what it means to be integrable. And we'll also show, while we're at it, that it's equal to the sum of these two integrals, the integral from a to c of f of x dx plus the integral from c to b of f dx. Okay, so we're going to prove those things together. All right, so let's do one of those at a time. So let's start with L. All right, so compute all right, so I'm going to start with this L of F. Okay, and so the first thing I can do is I want to compute the area under this curve here, right? So I'm going to take a partition where I get close, okay? I'm within epsilon, all right? So compute, maybe I'll add my here, for every epsilon. Okay, so I'm going to take L sub f is less than or equal to L of fp plus epsilon, right? So I can choose a fine enough partition so that I'm within epsilon of the right answer, right? So this I can do. Okay. I guess I'm going the other direction. I apologize. This is the proof the other way. So let me just start over and do the one that I do know. I apologize. So I'm assuming the other direction. So I'm assuming that we have these two ones. So the integral of L sub f restricted to AC. Right, sorry about that. So this one is less than or equal to lower integral here of f restricted to AC with some partition Q1 plus epsilon, right? So the picture again is I've got this one that I have assumed, and I can approximate it within epsilon, okay? So now I can do the same thing with the other one. So L of f restricted to CB is less than or equal to L with a partition, let me call it Q2, plus epsilon, okay? So I have a partition over here, and I have a partition and a partition over there, okay? So this, and I'm gonna take their union, and that'll be a partition of the whole thing, okay? So so we have that L of F is bigger than or equal to L of F with this partition Q1 union Q2, okay? And that's just equal to the two things I have above. So L of F restricted to AC with partition Q1 plus L of F restricted to CB with restriction Q2, okay? All right, and so then this is bigger than or equal to integral. Well, maybe I'll try to use the integral. That's what I'm trying to get. So the integral of f restricted to AC dx plus the integral of f restricted to CB dx, and I got some epsilons minus two epsilon. Okay, so did everyone see that? So I slid my epsilons over to the other side here. And I got this. Okay, and that's the same argument. So similarly, U of F is less than or equal to these integrals plus two epsilon. Okay, so we've sandwiched L and U between epsilon to epsilon. So U of F minus L of F is less than or equal to four epsilon. And this was for every epsilon. So U of F is equal to L of F. Is equal to the two integrals that we wanted, the integral of F A to C plus the integral of F C to D. Okay. All right, and I'm out of time, but I hope it's clear that the other direction is similar, which is the one I started to write down in the beginning. Maybe I'll just talk through it. I have just a few seconds, but the idea, of course, is as before, instead of choosing a partition for here and a partition for here, now I choose a partition for the whole thing. I make sure C is in it, and then I use it here, and I use it here, and those give me my two approximations. Okay. Some of you might try to write down one of those yourself. Okay, I'm out of time. I will stop here, and next time we'll add this to our collection and see what we ended up with. And I will stick around for questions.